Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
It was not a dogfighter.
Yeah.
It was too big for that. You know, it couldn't kind of mix it with Focke Wulf 190 or BF-109. But it had the speed to make itself very, very difficult to intercept. But it also could carry the same tonnage of bombs, same weight of bombs to Berlin as B-17 tended to carry, certainly an early model B-17.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Hello, everybody.
Good. Great to have you back. And of course, we are joined by that legend, Roland White. Roland, how are you?
Well, that's a very kind introduction. Nice to be back. It's lovely to be here again with you, Peter and Tim.
Thanks for joining us. Know you're immensely busy at the moment. The book has appears to be breaking all records, which is quite something given your previous publications. Just before we get into the book, how's everyone's summer been? I notice you've been out and about a little bit, Roland, and I know Tim's always out and about.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we had a lovely holiday this summer, which I got to say was the first time I've had some time off actually since finishing the book, which was a really, it was a long haul this time around. And so that was, it was lovely just to kind of read for fun and, you know, not have to kind of tap away every morning. But no, it's been a good summer. I've done some filming with James Holland, which was a first. We went up to Sir Sywell to film something he's working on. Actually also at Sywell, a proper kind of bucket list thing ticked off, went up in the Mustang there, which
wow.
was, that's probably the highlight of my year. I mean, just an amazing experience.
Wow. Tim, since we last spoke, have you been out and about, or you're off to Dubai soon as well, to the air show?
Yeah, so the Dubai Air Show is coming up in November, so I'll be off to that. The conference and lecture season is in full swing at the Royal Aeronautical Society, so that's a good. A couple of weeks ago, we had the Future of Flight Conference, which is pretty interesting, all about eVTOLs and advanced air mobility. And someone looking to bring, a Swedish company looking to bring airships back.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Watch this space, yeah. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that anyway, yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, let's waste no more time and jump into the book. And Tim, I'm going to hand over to you. I'm still partway through the book, so no spoiler alerts. No, only joking. Really,
yeah,
really.
So obviously we're politically delighted to welcome back Roland. 6th or 7th time, I believe. If you get to 10, we give you a badge. And latest book, Mosquito, has been published this month. I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, especially you, Peter, except to say it is a low-level, full-throttle read, part spy thriller, part gripping history of the D-Haven Mosquito, that brings its story, the people involved in the air, on the ground, to life. And it's a fitting tribute as well to those who paid the ultimate sacrifice, I think we can all agree. So, Roland, what is Mosquito all about?
Well, I mean, the climax of the book is the simple answer: the RAF raid on the Gestapo headquarters in Copenhagen in 1945, and that was certainly to some extent, the limit of the plan when I started on it. But as soon as you start scratching the surface of any subject, you realize kind of what richness and depth there is. And this was my first time writing about the Second World War, except in passing as well. And so I sort of came at it with all the enthusiasm that I think Bill Bryson found he discovered for science when he wrote sort of Short History of Anything. I mean, of everything, he came to that, you know, confessing to be a non-scientist. And so everything amazed and excited him. And the same is, to some extent, I think, true of the way I felt about writing Mosquito, in that you know, Second World War was ground I'd really not sort of explored in any depth before. And so I was sort of astonished at every turn by the extraordinary characters I came across, the amazing stories, the sort of heroism, the technological advance, the magnitude and the stakes, I suppose. And we're looking at Denmark as well, which is obviously kind of a bit off the beaten track with respect to what so much of what is written about Second World War. You know, I did have a subject that I hoped to really be able to make my own.
Excellent. So why did you, for obviously your first World War II book, but why did you write about the Mosquito? Surely that's been done quite a few times before. And why this particular raid as well?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the first part of the question, the second part of the question. The first part, actually, I was very surprised to find that over recent years, at any rate, the Mosquito seems to have been a little shortchanged. You know, we've obviously had books on the Spitfire from Jonathan Glancy and Leo McKinstry, more recently John Nicol, obviously. Leo and John both wrote about the Lancaster. Leo wrote a book about the Hurricane. None of those more recent general histories, I suppose histories, books for a general readership rather than a specialist audience, have looked at the Mosquito. And actually, that's a real surprise, given the level of affection that I've discovered since the book's been published, that there is for the machine. It's like the sort of aircraft world equivalent of the Fiji rugby team. It's like everybody's... it's obviously some people's favourite aeroplane, but it's certainly, if other people have favourites, the Mosquito is almost invariably their second favourite. I mean, the love of the Mosquito out there is enormous. So I was really surprised to find that I had this opportunity to kind of tap into that, I suppose. And then with respect to why I chose that raid, I think it's because I was sort of brought up on a diet of all those sort of old World War II films and the 633 Squadron movies that we know, along with Dambusters, sort of inspired the X-Wing attack on the Death Star. In Star Wars, featured these incredible low-level precision strikes, and Mosquito Squadron, the second one, actually sort of features, attack on a Gestapo headquarters in which there's a member of the resistance being tortured, which is one of the features of the story that I'm telling. So, of all of those raids, and perhaps Amiens, the raid on Amiens prison is the most well-known, the one which has been written about most often, it seemed to me that the one in which the stakes were highest, the one which was most difficult, complicated, at greatest range, and with the most capacity to go wrong, was this raid on the Gestapo headquarters in central Copenhagen. So it was me finding the closest analogy, I guess, to a real life 633 squadron, and I think that probably in the minds of the public. And it's those movies, I suspect, that are to blame for this. It is those low-level pinpoint raids that define the Mosquito. I mean, it was successful in so many different ways, but it's those pinpoint raids that I think first come to people's minds when they think of the Mosquito.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is it's a bit of a spy thriller as well, in kind of secret army, that kind of stuff. So was that always the plan, or is that something that kind no. of just grew and grew, and you expanded it to weave in through the, you know, no, the Mosquito, I mean, RAF part of it?
No, as I say, that was a real gift, and it came about really, as I say, as I scratched the surface of the book. I mean, I'd always known that there would be a sort of counterpoint to the RAF story through the the stories of the prisoners who were being kept in the attic of the Gestapo headquarters, the sort of high ranking members of the resistance put there after the bombing of another Danish Gestapo headquarters as a sort of human shield to prevent an RAF raid. But what I then subsequently realized that was that that raid offered the sort of climax to three different stories, one of which was that of the Danish resistance, and another one was the story of SOE and their work, the Special Operations Executive, and their work across occupied Europe. In Denmark, which was a kind of a unique case in terms of occupied Europe, they had an enormously important role to play. And unlike the rest of Europe, SOE also had it to themselves, kind of ostensibly at any rate, without SIS, MI6 involvement.
Yeah, and the raid on the HQ, I mean, the RAF had, kind of repeated requests to go and strike this. So why do you think they? Why do you think they were so hesitant with it? Was it because it was in a built-up area and they were worried about civilians, bad weather?
No, I mean absolutely. It was at the limit of the Mosquito's range for starters. There had been a raid actually in early 1943 by 105 Squadron, led by Huey Edwards VC, against a factory making U-boat parts in central Copenhagen. On that occasion, there was an aircraft lost, because it ran out of gas, before reaching home. So they knew that, this was, at the very limit of the Mosquito's range. It was also fascinating, alarming for the Air Force as a potential target because, as you say, it was right in the middle of a built-up area. The Air Officer Commanding Two Group, who's a legendary character, Air Vice Marshal Basil Embry, who I hope to make many more people aware of through the book, had feared that they might kill as many as 300 Danish civilians in Copenhagen simply because of the location of that Gestapo building. In the end, he said that he would only mount the raid if the decision was made by somebody in the field on the ground in Copenhagen. He would only take the risk, not primarily to his air crews, but only take the risk of those civilian deaths if the operation on the ground, the SOE on the ground, resistance, said, you have to do this. And it got to a point in January, February, where after a string of arrests of the resistance, the Gestapo were in real danger of rolling them up completely as a functioning organization. And had that happened, it had potentially disastrous effects for what remained of the war in Denmark for reasons I can go into. It's largely to do with the balance of power in Denmark and how, as happened in Paris, one faction moving against another in search of advantage after the war could actually trigger a very vicious German response. And it was that led Eisenhower to divert to Paris, was an early uprising by the communists. That was the risk potentially in Copenhagen, and obviously what happened in Warsaw was also much on people's minds. And there was a fear that if the resistance didn't survive, then Copenhagen too faced the sort of outcome that had obviously been so appalling in Warsaw.
I think it's interesting that your book sort of sets it in context there, in that one of the things that obviously people vaguely familiar with the mission now is the deaths of 86 school children at the school, and 130 out of 135 Danish civilians were killed. But that's lower than the RAF predicted. And also, I think it was at 500 school kids at the school in total. Yeah. So,
I mean,
terrible price, but
Exactly. I mean, and one gets it, I mean, you get, I'm very reluctant to sort of start looking at equivalents. Because, you know, there's no way around the tragedy of those kids' deaths. But I, very early on, while I was researching the book, I made contact with a man in Copenhagen called John Holstein. And John is now about 80 years old. He was 4 years old. He was weeks away from his fifth birthday and was a pupil at the Jeanne d'Arc French school in Copenhagen. And I went out to see John. And he's had a sort of remarkable life, actually. He was dug out of the rubble of the school and had a fear of flying after that. And as you might imagine, fear of aeroplanes. Until after the war, he was told he was going to go on holiday with his cousin to Lillehammer in Norway for skiing holiday. And they were going to fly together unaccompanied by their parents. He realized that unless he could overcome his fear of flying, and bear in mind, he's only about 7 years old, he was going to miss out on that holiday. So he saved up his pocket money, took himself down to Kastrup Airport, which is just outside Copenhagen, on the bus, and got on a plane to Malmo in Sweden, and then came back, was a little late for dinner at home. And his parents said, you know, where on earth have you been? And he told them he'd got on a plane to Sweden, in fact, 8-7. But John then subsequently went on to become the sort of godfather of sport parachuting in Denmark, an accomplished glider pilot and glider tug pilot with thousands of hours in his logbook, and made his living building parachute and search and rescue harnesses for gliders and helicopters. So aviation is sort of stitched into his life. And he took me around all of the sites in Copenhagen, and we went to the site of the school and stood on the avenue down which the mosquito that had crashed there and caused the confusion that led to the death of those school children. And he sort of towed some of the leaves away from the kids, from the memorials that's been erected there to the kids that lost their lives. And he sort of looked up and down the avenue, and he sort of considered the sacrifice of the air crews that had lost their lives to save the Danish resistance and to save Denmark. And he just said quietly to himself, they were heroes. That had a profound effect on me, that somebody who had suffered so much in that raid could be so understanding and so forgiving, and yet the memory of it all to remain so powerful for him. And, you know, that it was a reflection of the reaction actually within Denmark as a whole. I mean, it obviously remains a controversial episode, but Basil Embry, Ted Sismore, the 23-year-old lead navigator on the mission, his pilot, Bob Bateson, and Bob Iredale, the CEO of the Australian Squadron 464, were invited out to Denmark after the war. They met the parents of some of the kids who'd lost their lives. They met the teachers and the nuns at the convent school, and they laid a wreath there. They were made extremely welcome, Ted Sismore said throughout the day, he kept being told by the people, the Danes that he met, we understand, you know, we do understand. Yeah. And he says, I don't know how they could have understood. And it was the most moving thing he said he'd ever experienced.
So presumably you've seen the Netflix film, The Bombardment. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's a very singular vision. I think it's an art house movie. It's not. I mean, it's telling a story by a Danish auteur director. Mm. It's not much concerned with getting the details of what happened right. I mean, it's not a documentary. You know, it's beautifully made. It's bleak as hell, and I think it paints, in my view, an unfairly negative picture of the RAF and the efforts they made to save lives. It's simply not accurate to suggest that the pilot who crashed, who was the new boss of 21 Squadron, Peter Klebo, was in some way sort of shell-shocked, anxious, incapable, shouldn't have been in an aeroplane. And that's very much the impression that you get from the movie. And as I say, I think that that is, I don't think that's fair to his memory or that of his navigator.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the low-level flying CGI was brilliant, and the terrifying bit of mosquito going down in the city and fighting for control. Yeah. But I was a little bit kind of disturbed by the opening thing of a kind of war crime that was kind of carried out on the taxi cab full of kind of young girls going to a wedding or something, which seemed
you're right. I mean, it sets out its stall very, very early. I didn't watch it until I had finished the book and it was already going to print, and I sort of deliberately didn't. But I did watch it, knowing that the book was going to be published and it might well come up in interviews. And you're right. I mean, the way that the flying scenes have been recreated is really beautifully done. But as I say, it shouldn't be regarded as a factual account of what happened, because it's drawn on the truth of it all in order to tell the story that the director wanted to tell.
Yeah. So we've kind of mentioned it a little bit with Basil Embry, but the book features a roll call of memorable supported characters, RAF commanders, secret agents, Danish SAS heroes, and even a would-be Hitler assassin. So who is your favourite out of that?
My favourite, I think, there's so many of them. I'll go through a handful of them and see if I can come to a conclusion by the end. There was a real gift offered to me as a writer in terms of trying to stitch together a narrative from the events that happened, which was the meeting in summer of 1939, just before the war broke out. Two families in Denmark, the Wichfelds and the Lassens. The matriarch of the Wichfeld family, Monica, was an Anglo-Irish aristocrat who married a Dane and went off to run his estate in southern Denmark. And her best friend, Suzanne Lassen, was a children's book illustrator. And the two families went to stay with each other in summer of 1939, and the kids were there. Monica's daughter, Varinka Inky, was there. She was such a sort of spirited child that Suzanne actually used her as the inspiration for a children's book character. And then Suzanne Lassen's sons were there, Anders and Franz, and their cousin, Axel. They were a Danish-German family, and their cousin Axel was from Germany. And so between them, they had a really extraordinary war. Monica led the resistance on the Danish island of Lolland, and she was the first woman sentenced to death by the Nazis. Her daughter, Varinka, married the head of the chief organizer of the SOE in Copenhagen. And then subsequently, after they had to escape the Gestapo back to the UK, flew back into RAF Lucas. She then earned her own parachute wings and was training to fly back into Copenhagen as a secret agent. And then Suzanne Lassen's sons, Anders, became the only member of the wartime SAS to win the VC. His brother, Franz, was parachuted back into Copenhagen as a explosives instructor. And their cousin, Axel, was part of an elite Prussian regiment that was tasked with establishing a sort of cordon sanitaire around a massacre of the Jews by the SS in Ukraine. And he was so disgusted and appalled by that that he felt he knew he could no longer serve Hitler's regime. To avoid that, he could either desert, he'd either be killed in combat or try and do something about it. And he opted for the latter. He found Klaus von Stauffenberg and the German resistance, and they hatched a plan to assassinate Hitler. He was very tall, blonde, and sort of typically Germanic looking, Aryan looking. he was going to be used as the model for some new Eastern Front uniforms at Hitler's Wolf's Lair in East Prussia, Wolf's Lair headquarters. And they were all in place. Van den Busch was up there. The instructions, the orders that were going to follow, with sort of directions for the coup, were all in place. And then the prototype uniforms, which were in a box car in Marshalling Yard in Berlin, were bombed by mosquitoes, ironically enough, in the days just before the Battle of Berlin. Began, and the heavies hit Berlin. So that never happened. And by the time he subsequently lost a leg on the Eastern Front, and so when Klaus von Stauffenberg made his own attempt on Hitler's life, Axel was in a hospital bed recovering from his wounds, and so escaped the purges that followed. And he survived the war and became a diplomat, set up the German peace guard. I mean, those five characters are an absolute gift. And that's just on the Danish side. I mean, Basil Embry was the son of a vicar. He was shot down in Battle of France in a Blenheim on a mission that was actually followed the end of his tour, but he couldn't resist one last crack after giving up or handing over command of the squadron to his successor. He was then in France for 4 months. He was captured twice. He escaped by killing his guards, hiding in a manure heap for a whole afternoon, nicked a bike, cycled to Paris, got to the American embassy, tried to convince them he was American. They weren't having any of it. He eventually made his way south with the refugees into southern France, tried to escape by boat, couldn't, eventually got over the border and Perpignan and went straight back wanting to take up the fight. He was then sent off to the desert where he advised Mary Conyngham, went back on through Malta to advise on their fighter requirements, and Spitfires arrived quite soon after that. Then became boss of a night fighter squadron, where he first familiarized himself with the Mosquito before being given command of Two Group when Second Tactical Air Force was formed. And Two Group had a kind of motley collection of aeroplanes and were threatened with the Vulti Vengeance dive bomber from the States. when he heard this news, he went straight to Boston Down to try one out, and he said, he wasn't having any of it. He said, it's an absolute death trap and there's no way I'm taking Two Group to war in one of those. And he insisted on Mosquitoes. They did keep the Bostons and Mitchells that they already had as medium level bombers, but he got his two wings of Mosquitoes, and they're the ones that the focus of my book is on. But he didn't just sort of sit back and send his Mosquitoes into battle. He had some dog tags made up in the name of Wing Commander Smith and had that name stitched into his battle dress, took his kind of Air Vice Marshal stripes off and would go on all of the... He was actually banned by Lee Mallory from going on the Amiens prison raid and ordered to go to a meeting at Bentley Priory, so just to make sure that he was actually in the country. but he went on all the, he went on all of those Danish raids, and he was his lead navigator to Group HQ. was Ted Sismore, who he was 21 when he led a three Mosquito raid, a daylight raid to Berlin to interrupt a speech by Hermann Göring on the anniversary of the accession of the Nazis to power. He was 22 when he planned the Amiens prison raid, and he was 23 wow. when he led the low-level raids to Gestapo headquarters in Copenhagen and in Jutland as well. And he was a remarkable character. I mean, to get to the right place, you had to navigate your way across the North Sea at just 50 feet, and there are no navigational features across the North Sea. What he used to use was a copy of the North Sea Pilot, the Admiralty book designed for people who were sailing around the North Sea coast, because it would list things like lighthouses or particularly high sand dunes was the one I enjoyed. And that's how he would make sure that he was coasting in at the right place. And I mean, he went on to become, it was 23 at the end of the war. As far as I can tell, the RAF's most decorated navigator, and had a distinguished post-war career as well. And then one of them, told you there were a few I like. Jazz Storer was a Battle of Britain ace at the age of 19. He was a son of a vet from Chester. He was the first person to fly into occupied France, because he was, at that time, he was part of something called the Air Delivery Letter Service, so that he would be delivering intelligence orders, important documents to commanders on either side of the Channel. And he also flew in to Paris before the liberation in a Hurricane with orders for the French resistance to try to get them not to revolt against the Germans, to stand down while Eisenhower bypassed on the way to Germany. But he was flying one of the Mustangs that escorted the Mosquitoes to Copenhagen. And again, a kind of larger than life character. And then, I mean, the Mosquito. Let's go for Basil Embry.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 flying fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Strangest facts you've dug up. I quite like the one about the, was it British Wood Commission or Timber Control going hunting around South Central America to find the right wood, or the use of napalm, which doesn't get talked about.
Those two things. I mean, The wood thing was interesting. I mean, you often hear, and I think kind of less and less so now, and people like James Holland are offering a sort of powerful corrective to this idea that we were a kind of bunch of amateurs in the face of kind of German professionalism. In fact, in many ways, Britain was extremely well prepared for the outbreak of the war. And one of the ways in which it had prepared was to set up a timber commission, which was ready to go. It's called Timber Control, ready to go immediately after the outbreak of the war, set up in Bristol. And its job was to look after all of the timber requirements that wartime Britain had. And that could range from lollipop sticks for ice cream manufacturers to the battens needed to repair battleships. One of the reasons the Mosquito kind of made it, survived the focus that there was on a small number of airplanes in the early years of the war, was because it was made of wood and didn't require strategic materials. But wood was enormously important to the war effort too. And balsa wood, which the Mosquito relied on as part of the plywood sandwich that its fuselage and wings were made of, was only found in the forests of Ecuador. So Timber Control sent an expedition off to Central America led by a well-known explorer to try to find alternative sources of balsa. And he led this expedition around seven different Central American countries and did find one or two alternative sources, none of which were of the quality required. But then in Panama, he found another kind of wood called quipo, which shared some of the properties of balsa. And he sent some back. And I think de Havilland even made a a sort of trial fuselage out of Kipo and plywood, or the plywood sandwich with a Kipo inside, and it worked. But by that time, their concerns about supply of balsa had been alleviated. But by the middle of 1942, they had set up an entirely brand new sawmill on an island in the Darien Gap, which is kind of almost uniquely inhospitable place, ready to supply Kipo wood for mosquito production should it be needed.
So mosquitoes from the Mosquito Coast.
Yeah, amazingly enough.
You can make it up. So here's what you said about the strategic, strategic materials and, Bomber Command is obviously focused on the Lancaster. I mean, there's some incredible stats about that. How many people are involved in the Lancaster supply chain and building those? So one of the key questions, I think, for people, for Mosquito fans, for World War II, say enthusiasts, if World War II inflicted, is could Bomber Command built more Mosquitoes instead of four-engine bombers? And had we gone low level, would that have had a bigger effect on the strategic bombing offensive? Could the war have been won earlier, quicker, and at a lower cost if you'd have got rid of the Lancasters and just gone for Mosquitoes?
I think the answer, as a kind of counterfactual sort of what if, my answer would be yes. I think that had it been possible to change direction and re-equip Bomber Command with an all-Mosquito force, I think that, we could have gone after the targets we really wanted to go after and hit them at a significantly lower cost in men and material and a vastly lower cost in German civilian lives. And I suspect by doing so, we'd have also shortened the course of the war by 6 months or more. The reality was, though, that there weren't enough kind of carpenters in the country to make that many. I mean, it would have required changing the whole industrial base of the country to do that. And so had it been possible, yes, we could have shortened the war. But had we tried, I think we'd have probably ended up lengthening the war, because the change from doing this to doing that was simply too great.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I like from you, because your observation there that the Mosquitoes carried out all the roles of air power, you know, all the traditional roles. So you've got control of the air, fighter, surveillance, attack, and transport. So any other contenders that come to mind for that? Is that unique?
I mean, there really aren't, as far as I can, you can sort of think of a number that do three of them. I'd love to be corrected. I'd love somebody to point
Junkers,
out.
Junkers 88, maybe?
Was the Junkers 88 ever in airline service, carrying passengers?
No, transport, only maybe emergency.
Carrying somebody on their lap. But that's the thing, is that, you know, the Mosquito, and I made the point in the book that it had a sort of almost a Goldilocks quality in terms of its size and surplus power and consequently sort of performance. It really was just right. It was fast enough to be effective as, I mean, it was not an escort fighter. I mean, that should sort of just put that kind of idea to bed, that, you know, why didn't we just use, it was not a dogfighter. It was too big for that. You know, it couldn't kind of mix it with a Focke Wulf 190 or a BF-109. But it had the speed to make itself very, very difficult to intercept. But it also could carry the same tonnage of bombs, same weight of bombs to Berlin as B-17 tended to carry, certainly an early model B-17. But it had the speed to do that twice in the time that it took a B-17 to do it once. And it carried a crew of two instead of a crew of 10. And then, you know, obviously the intelligence and reconnaissance, and it played a critical role as a photo reconnaissance bird, you know, much championed by Elliot Roosevelt, the president's son. But also it was employed as a radio relay by the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Army Air Force, and played a critical role in gathering intelligence from OSS spies, the forerunner of the CIA, Office of Secret Services. And they would use mosquitoes to relay the short-range radio transmissions from their spies in Germany back to the UK. So intelligence, but that getting pressed into service as a cargo plane and passenger aircraft flown in unarmed BOAC liveried mosquitoes, it sort of completes that quartet, and I think it makes the Mosquito unique. You know, it was carrying ball bearings, which were vital for the manufacture of every single aero engine from Sweden, which made the best of them. And sometimes it was completing. There was one night where a single Mosquito and a single Mosquito crew completed that flight between RAF Lucas and Bromma in Sweden three times in 9 hours, and they spent just three quarters of an hour on the ground. All the time they're flying the sort of gauntlet of German night fighters and air defences that sort of pincered the north of Denmark and the south of Norway. That's where you got your Junkers 88s. The DC-3s and other aeroplanes used by the Swedes, Norwegians and the British on that route were all incredibly vulnerable to the night fighters. And you know, it was a Swedish DC-3 was shot down. So the Germans would tend to, Luftwaffe would shoot first and ask questions later. While a couple of Mosquitoes were lost, and certainly one was shot up by a FW-190, none is ever believed to have been lost as a result of enemy action. None was ever thought to have been shot down.
Oh, right.
But it was okay. I mean, carrying the passengers in the Bombay was an extraordinary innovation. You know, they lined the Bombay with felt. They gave them a flask of coffee, sandwich, and an oxygen mask. And then they flew them from Sweden to the UK. So 2.5-3 hour flight. And perhaps the most famous passenger of all was Niels Bohr. If you've seen Oppenheimer, you'll remember Kenneth Branagh kind of jokes about having, been put in the Bombay by the British pilots. In actual fact, on his flight, they were Norwegian pilots employed by BOAC. But also, he was put in the Bombay, but he had a really large head, Niels Bohr. The oxygen mask didn't actually fit him properly. He wasn't, for a nuclear scientist, terribly practical in lots of other ways, not kind of particularly worldly necessarily. So he kind of got it all wrong and passed out. The crew couldn't communicate with him via the intercom between the cockpit and the Bombay, and they had no direct access to the Bombay. And they're worried that they'd killed the scientist who, after Albert Einstein, was the most famous in the world, you know, Nobel Prize winning nuclear physicist who'd been who was required back in the UK, but ultimately by the Manhattan Project as well, for his expertise and also his knowledge of what he believed was more advanced than had previously been thought German atom bomb program.
Yeah. Wow. So don't get any ideas, Ryanair, about putting passengers in your unpressurized cargo compartments. That's all I say. What do you think was the Mosquito's influence on aircraft and design and tactics going forward? Obviously, it's a World War II aircraft. Yeah. Post-World War II, jets take over. Has it got a heritage or a legacy that kind of lives on?
I think a really substantial one. I mean, the most obvious example of an aeroplane sort of following the general Mosquito approach would be the Canberra, which obviously actually continues to enjoy an enormously successful career. Yeah. If you count the sort of Franken-cameras used by NASA still, the sort of big wing WB-57s. But the Canberra essentially followed the same approach to design as the Mosquito. But beyond that, and I think this is one of the other reasons that what Two Group were doing in the Second World War is so interesting, is that if you discount the nuclear mission that the V-bombers carried out, the way that Two Group approached what they were doing, which was to get in and out at low level, below the radar, to greatly complicate the both the ability of the air defences to intercept them using fighters or shoot them down using radar and flat guns on the ground, and then use that low-level approach to strike really accurately, even without sophisticated avionics, at minimal cost to the surrounding area because of that precision, at minimal cost to the aircrew, but also at minimal cost to the public purse strings, as a result of throwing away all sorts of bombs that don't go anywhere near the target. I think that they worked out. Baz Lembri includes a table about this in his memoir. I think he, after the campaign against the V1 sites, which were all along the Atlantic coast in occupied Europe, France, Belgium, Holland, etc., worked out that the Mosquitoes required a fifth less tonnage of bombs to take out at one of those V1 sites than any other bomber being used.
Yeah.
That's a really remarkable statistic.
And I suppose it goes from, twin-engined, twin-seat aircraft, yeah, going at low level, you're navigating by IPs. The other thing is the dedicated chap they've got who was looking at all the flak over Europe, Okay, so we've got some listener questions for you as well. So there's a couple of questions here from Andrew Bird and Ian Allen, who says, what's next? What's your next book? What's planned next?
Well, I'm always sort of reluctant. Whatever I say is unlikely to be it, because I think you've asked me that question before, and it's always been something other than what I've ended up saying on the podcast. And I also kind of offered a hostage to fortune in Harrier 809 by saying, look, here's an advanced snippet of the book I'm going to write next, which was going to be called Dambuster 617. And was going to be all about the 617's participation in the 1984 Strategic Air Command bombing competition, and the way in which some of the lessons learnt there were then subsequently employed by the RAF in 1991 when they moved from those low-level tactics. I mean, this is interesting in relation to the Mosquito. You asked about its legacy, and you kindly kind of clarified the point I managed to kind of get distracted from completing, which was that, the RAF essentially adopted a low-level approach using twin-engine aircraft, flying at low level with a crew of two make sure that they were capable of hitting the target, getting in and out and hitting their target. And that approach really persisted until 1991, when obviously the Tornadoes, which were ultimately the modern expression of that approach established by the Mosquito, were hit really, really hard in the first few days of the Gulf War. And once the air defences offered a more permissive environment, were moved to medium level and quickly equipped with their own laser guided bombs and tile pods so that they could strike with precision from a medium altitude. And that has tended to be the approach that's been taken since 1991. And obviously with stealth and with the F-35, you know, the idea is that you don't need to go in at low level to evade the air defences.
Yeah, exactly. So
we've also said what's next. All I would say is that it's a toss-up at the moment between going back to that and sticking with the Second World War. And I might, I've got a funny feeling I might have caught the Second World War bug, but we'll we shall see. We shall see.
Okay, so we've got a couple of other questions here. Somebody, a little VC tenderness says, what's the most surprising fact or story about the Mozzie you found? I think we covered that a little bit. What prompted you? But I think we've already kind of covered that. But feel free to add to if there's another surprising fact or story that comes to your mind. Yeah.
I think that the thing about the sawmill in Panama was the real surprise to me. I mean, there was one or two other ones. I enjoyed finding out that at the end of the war, the mosquitoes were used essentially. This was after the liberation and the Nazis' defeat. That were used as a sort of fleet of kind of essentially private jets. They were used as the fast to get people around Europe quickly. You know, on one occasion, Stalin required the most senior German general, whose name now escapes me annoyingly, but most senior German field marshal from what remained of Third Reich leadership. He required his presence in Berlin, I think, to sign the surrender with this document with Soviet Union. And he was flown there by one of the 464 Squadron Mosquitoes.
With obviously the pilot, kind of not the temptation there to move near the bomb drop release lever.
I like to think he was put in the front a little bit, okay. Like Hannibal Lecter with a ice hockey mask on.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody here, we've got Henry Cobb, who's asking, if Germany fielded jets earlier, would they had a field day swatting mosquitoes?
That's
the 262.
The 262s did get the mosquitoes. You know, obviously they could fly faster, they could fly higher. But that superior performance doesn't automatically ensure victory. The mosquitoes could still give a decent. There are many accounts of mosquitoes managing to get away from quite persistent attacks by the 262s. Intercepting an aeroplane flying at speed and at height is a difficult thing to do. Even if you have a speed advantage, you know, you're talking about sort of vectors and triangulating the piece of the sky you need to be in at the point that you need to be there. Otherwise, you're going to need, greater overtake capability and range and endurance to be able to make up the ground if you're in the wrong piece of sky. So, yes, potentially they'd if they'd had greater performance earlier, they'd have made life a lot harder for the mosquitoes. I don't think that necessarily it would have been a war-winning difference. And remember, of course, that we were not. It's not that we weren't developing jets of our own at the same time as well.
Certainly, yes. So, we like the mosquito because it goes fast, it goes flies high, it's hard hitting. What do you think is the worst thing about it?
I defer to Colin Bell, the legendary 101-year-old former mosquito pilot, who said, it tended to pull to the left a bit on takeoff.
Yeah, it has got quite a nasty takeoff swing apparently. And have you been inside a mosquito? Have you had a look inside the cockpit?
I've stuck my head inside one at the de Havilland Museum. I hope I'll get to sit in the cockpit at some point. The trouble is that I was doing this in COVID, and so it was, yeah, you know, there are all sorts of things I might have been able to do, which I didn't sort of get to do. On a slightly more serious note about the mosquito and what was the worst thing about it, did tend to pull a bit to the left on takeoff. A more worrying aspect of the takeoff was that you didn't have sufficient speed when you were fully loaded at takeoff to be able to cope with an engine failure. And so the technique was to stay low, to build up speed over the airfield, and only once you'd gained sufficient speed, then go into your climb. Because unless you gained that extra speed, if you had an engine failure before that, there was, you know, you weren't going to get out of that. You weren't going to survive it.
And so I think some of the just looking at the cockpit ergonomics as well seems to be designed with the fuel tank switches right behind the pilot, so it's, only the navigator can actually get to them. I mean, kind of interesting. I think we're coming to the end of the Peter. Have you got some questions?
There's just a couple to mop up on, Roland. Ian Allen asks, have you been to New Zealand to see the mosquitoes being restored there?
I haven't, but I would love to. I mean, New Zealand features greatly in the book, because 140 Wing, which is the focus of what I'm writing about, was made up of three squadrons, 21 Squadron RAF, 464 Squadron Royal Australian Air Force, and 487 Squadron Royal New Zealand Air Force. And within those squadrons, they had, you know, obviously Brits, Australians, New Zealanders. They had South Africans, they had Americans, they had Canadians, they had Jamaicans, Trinidadians. And pilots from France, the Netherlands, no Danes during the time that I was writing about it. But I mean, it was a really, really international collection of pilots. But there were some remarkable New Zealanders that that I got to write about in the book. And it seems, with that thought in mind, only fitting that New Zealand has become such a kind of hub for not restoring, but rebuilding and recreating mosquitoes. And it's, I mean, I'm just so excited about the idea that they're building one that we're going to see come to Biggin Hill.
That's right, yeah. Biggin Hill in 2026. Yeah. So I suppose we'll kind of round it up. I suppose the last question would be a reaction to the book. What is the great public saying?
Oh, I've... people have been.
It seems pretty positive. It seems pretty positive.
Don't be bashful, Roland.
So I told my wife Lucy that a review of the book in the Express had described me as a distinguished aviation historian, and she told me to empty the dishwasher and put all that stuff in the attic. That was exactly the reaction of that kind of self-aggrandizing. As I say, it's the first time I've written about Second World War. I wanted to try, while doing justice to the memories of the people who lost their lives, and you know the scale of the kind of catastrophe during the Second World War is so immense. But you know, against that backdrop, there were so many instances of incredible grace and heroism and courage, endurance, and skill. And I wanted to try to make sure I did justice to both sides of that story, or both sides of that, in a story that really grabbed people and felt as if it, read like a thriller. And I, you know, by saying that, I don't want to make it sound glib. I just want it to be sufficiently engaging that that it kind of sugars the pill of the sort of substantial content that's in there. So I hope it reads like a kind of, Top Gun Maverick in book form. But I hope that there will be occasions through the book that genuinely move people to tears in terms of the powerful emotions that the story evokes.
Roland, one final question. Obviously, the book has been very widely distributed. We've seen it in lots of places. But Robert Archer wants to know if there's any way of accessing any signed copies. Is there any way the publisher or anything?
I'm going up to a bookshop on Friday called Cole's Books, and they're in Bicester. So Coles, Cole's Books in Bicester. Actually, it's going to be too late when this goes out, isn't it?
Going out on Sunday. we'll have to get him to keep an eye out.
I'm going to be at the de Havilland Museum on Saturday the 28th between 12 and 2.
Wonderful.
And, so I'll be able to sign books if somebody's there. If not, I think that within reason, I think if people get in touch with me through my website, there's a contact section on my website, which is rolandwhite.com. And just ask if there's a way of kind of organizing it. Generally speaking, what I ask people to do is order a book online, deliver it to me at work. I can then sign it to them and post it back to them.
So wonderful.
If people can't make it to the Havilland Museum, just drop me an email through my website.
Wonderful.
Fantastic.
Roland, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I think it's a great book. I mean, I'm so pleased of the reaction to it. Some of the people who are sort of commenting have read it, like me. You know, we're a hard to please audience, put it this way, in terms of aviation books. Really good.
Thank you very much. I can't tell you how anxiety inducing that thought is when a book's about to break cover. Because as I say, this is kind of new territory for me. And you just think, I just kind of went thinking. Publish it thinking there's so many people who know so much more about this than me. I just hope I don't end up in my face.
No, you haven't. Listen, before we go, we want to thank those listeners who have engaged with us and left us reviews. If you haven't, do something to give back and write a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts for us. We're really, really keen to hear your comments and feedback on Roland's book in particular. So contact us on social media or by email. We'll happily pass those on to Roland if you've got any more questions. So, Roland, where can we find you online?
It's my website is rolandwhite.com, and remember, it's Roland with a W, rolandwhite.com. You can find it through the rolandwhite.com website, but I've also got all those t-shirts at projectcancelled.com as well, if people are interested in seeing them.
And Tim, how about you? Where can we find you in the Aero Society?
Aero Society is www.aerosociety.com, and I'm still on the artist formerly known as Twitter, X, on there at @RESTimR.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course you can also find Ellie and Gareth on the Twitter, Facebook, Threads, Instagram, extended feeds as well. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Roland White.
Goodbye. Thanks for having me on.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
from across the globe, from the centre of aerospace. And now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.